MMR 101.3 FM. People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, Rodney Trojan welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. I was lucky enough to be invited to the opening of Amadeus, that remarkable play about Mozart and Salieri by Peter Schaeffer. It's on at the Theatre on the Bay, and it stars, among other people, Alan Committee as Salieri and Aidan Scott as Mozart. And it was quite a tour de force, which you'll hear about, because they say this thrilling drama has all the elements: suspense, comedy, rousing music, and great characters, set in the court of the Austrian Emperor Joseph II. And Antonio Salieri is the established composer. Enter the greatest musical symphonist of all time, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Salieri has given himself to God so that he might realize his sole ambition to be a great melodist. Mozart, however, is a foul-mouthed, graceless oaf who has that which is beyond Salieri's envious grasp, genius. Playing, as I said, the role of Salieri is Alan Committee, the South African comic actor, also a qualified high school teacher. So, Alan, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
It was, may I say this, when I saw the cast list and I saw Alan Committee playing Salieri, I thought, this is going to stretch credibility a bit, because you are so well known as a comedian.
Yeah.
And I thought Salieri is really quite a dark and tragic role. So when you were offered it, did you jump at it? I know you say it's your favorite play.
It is my favorite play, and it's at the very top, or was at the very top of my bucket list of plays to do. So the fact that I'm able to do it now is an extraordinary privilege and a delight. To come back to your question, to me it wasn't obviously, to me, it wasn't a big surprise, because I studied first as an actor all those years ago at UCT. And the stand-up and the comedy came to me fairly easily, but much later, or not much later, 2 or 3 years into my acting career. And throughout my acting career, I've always tried at least once a year to do something that stretches my acting abilities, other than stand-up comedy and solo shows. And so for a number of years, I've done, whether it's a musical with producers playing Max Bialystock or Little Shop of Horrors. I've done Richard III at Maynardville playing Richard III. Oliana, David Mamet, which is a very dramatic and quite intense two-hander. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf playing George. So, I think slowly I've kind of taught the audience that there are possibilities in the way I perform. And,
So
Salieri for me was always the, as I said, at the very top of my bucket list. And I've been wanting to do it. Let me tell you the story. 22, 23 years ago, when I was still teaching at Westerford, I decided to do Amadeus as a school production. Now, not your first choice as a school production.
No, I was going to say.
And playing Mozart was a young Luke Ellenbogen, Nick Ellenbogen's son, and who is, ironically, the production manager on this production. And John Gamble, who later became a fine South African actor who's traveled overseas now, playing Salieri, both of them in Matric at Westerford. And directing that show at school level made me fall in love with the text, realized the brilliance of Schaeffer's writing, the extraordinary story that he tells. And it was shortly around that time that I kind of went, in time, I want to play Salieri. You might assume that I'd be drawn to the Mozart part, which is the showy kind of comic part in a way, or not comic necessarily, but certainly the charismatic and high energy part. But as you said rightly, Salieri is a very dark, enigmatic man driven by jealousy and envy, by intense ambition, and by a profound love initially for God, which then turns into a rage because he feels like he's been overlooked. The play's title is interesting because Amadeus, you would think, refers to Wolfgang, and of course it does. But Amadeus as a word means beloved of God. And
That's interesting.
Right. And so in a way, it's about the notion of who is beloved of God. And Salieri, who thought he deserved to be beloved of God, reacts to his changing circumstances. And he's driven to this moment in his life where he has to make a choice. How can he stop his arch rival, his nemesis? Now, we should say to the listeners, because I suspect some of them will write in or phone in and tell you this wasn't true.
Yes, yes.
And of course it wasn't.
Schaeffer
did some interesting research in some of Mozart's diaries towards the end of his, sadly, very short life. He wrote, sometimes under the influence of alcohol, we are told, he wrote a number of times that he felt threatened by a number of composers who were his peers, including Bach, but certainly Salieri. And three times, I think he mentions, I think he's poisoning me. I feel threatened. He's very jealous of me.
Mm.
But of course, he said that of many people in these kind of moments of vulnerability. And Schaffer looked at that, looked at the point that of all those composers in that period, Salieri is the one who was so well known in his time, but is hardly ever played today. Yes. It's only recently, I'm told, in the last 3 or 4 years, that his work has kind of come back into, at least into consideration, and they've released an album of some of Salieri's music, and actually it's quite beautiful.
Well, we play a fair amount of Salieri's music.
Ah, that's interesting.
Because, and it's interesting when they program together a Mozart piece and a Salieri piece. And he was a very accomplished composer.
Correct.
But he didn't have, as they said, the genius.
He didn't have the genius.
And that wonderful, one of the most touching scenes is when he's talking about that wind serenade.
Yes.
About the sort of box,
yes,
over which comes that oboe tune.
Correct.
And how could anyone as vulgar as Mozart have written something
and
as
created something
as that?
And that's this beautiful play. And so again, Schaffer's obviously taken some dramatic license, but he's created this incredible text, written of course in 1979, the play, and produced so many times around the world. And you saw it last night. It's the kind of thing that could have been written last week.
Yes.
It really doesn't feel like it's of a time.
No.
Because the themes are and the characters are so universal.
I want to talk about the way the show looks, the way the play looks, because if I remember correctly, and I'm sure I do, it wasn't very, the set was actually quite plain.
So initially in the 1980s, the big Broadway and West End productions were very lush. They had the money. The company was 18 strong, so it was a very big company. And they had supers on top of that for the listener. A super is basically a stagehand who has a couple of lines, who also moves furniture. It was lush. It was very Baroque. And it lent into this idea of a court, a very plush court. And within that, which was then of its time, the establishment, this rock and roll youngster coming in and disrupting.
Yes.
That was the idea. Now, cut to 2024 in South Africa with a weak rand, with a diminishing theatre audience. We have to make different choices. I was thrilled that I could get Jeff Hyland to direct. He directed me in my Richard III. I've known him for many years. He was also one of my lecturers at UCT Drama School. And when I sat with him, I said to him, I'd love to look at this as not as a spectacle, but as a chamber piece to continue the music metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
Let's concentrate just on the text. Let's tell the story brilliantly. Let's reduce the cast to a cast of 8, have them all stay on stage. Let's make the few elements that we do have in terms of design elements, a table, a couple of chairs, a kind of cutout of a pianoforte, but not a real one.
Mm-hmm.
Let's make them live in the best and most efficient way they can. And let's focus on the story. And that was our task. And I think we've actioned it pretty well. And certainly people have responded to that. And in combination, I would add, with Ollie Hauser's superb lighting, because it creates atmospherically
amazing
transitions in the story.
I must say it certainly works, because from my point of view sitting there, I was not distracted by anything.
Amazing.
And the text suddenly hit
comes
me
alive,
even more so than other productions.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's
so
exactly, you know, I wasn't privy, unfortunately, I was a bit young, but when Peter Turin opened the Alhambra in Joburg in 1980, he did so with his favorite show at the time, which was Amadeus, with a superb cast, Ralph Lawson playing Mozart and Richard Haynes originating the part. I think Michael Atkinson took over 6 months into it. But that would have been very much in the style of the old, with the full cast.
Yes.
I'd love to be able to do that. Please, someone give me the money to do it like that. But I think the way we've chosen to do it and conceptualized the show and edited it a little bit, I think it works. And as for a new audience, it focuses on the story, which for me is the most important thing.
Well, it's going to introduce a whole lot of people to Mozart.
I hope so.
And maybe even Salieri.
Absolutely.
Imagine that. Let's just have a music break. And what are you choosing, Alan? I mean,
yes.
Some Mozart, I hope.
Absolutely some Mozart to get us. We've been talking about it. And I chose the piece that actually, interestingly, opens the movie version of Amadeus, which people might remember. It won 10 Oscars, came out in 1984. And, of course, Peter Schaffer reimagined his stage text into a cinema form. And the movie opens with a Symphony No. 25 in G minor by Mozart. It is superbly cinematic. And again, if you remember, this music was written so many hundreds of years earlier.
Mm.
He's created something that any modern film composer might have written. And it takes us into the heart of the story with a lot of drama.
part of the first movement of Mozart's Symphony No. 25. It's sometimes called the little G minor because that is a very sort of anxious key
right. That
you hear there, as you said so rightly, almost sounding like film music
yeah.
for Amadeus. And it was the first choice of my guest, who is Alan Committee, who plays Salieri in the production of Amadeus, which is at the Theatre on the Bay. And just before the music, Alan, we were talking about the film.
Mm.
And I think for many people, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, the film was very important and was the thing they mentioned or remembered mostly.
Absolutely.
Because talk about lavish, that was certainly a lavish film.
It was a
film.
Brilliant movie. And yeah. It captured, as you know, sometimes when they make a film adaptation of a stage show, it somehow feels too stagey or too, it should be still on the stage.
Yes.
Or it deviates so badly that they couldn't be bedfellows at all. And of course, what Milos Forman, the director, did so brilliantly, and of course, and Peter Schaefer, I think, is that they worked and collaborated so well in making a film version of that brilliant play. So it has one or two differences. It can start, for example, with a much older Salieri recounting.
Yes.
And so some
flashbacks.
Of the plot points, yes, have changed. And as you say, in terms of the cinema style, it becomes incredibly lavish and they can take you to the actual sites of the palace
yeah.
and Mozart in his hovel. A stage play has to rely on theatrical tricks and the audience's buy-in to a lot of that. But again, then the words become more important.
As you've been saying through.
Exactly. And whereas in the film version, it's the visual that takes preference.
Yeah.
But it is. It's an extraordinary film. It won everyone, I think, involved. I think it was nominated for 14 and won 10 Oscars.
Oh, I know.
And
yes,
it was an extraordinary thing. And we were saying off air, I've got a DVD version with an extended cut by the director. And that also is interesting to see how he can shift, because he focuses, and in the second cut of the movie, a little bit more on Mozart's story, whereas Schaefer initially reminds us that actually this, although it's called Amadeus, it's Salieri's story about
yes.
Mozart.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's through his eyes. And this is a demented man who, in the play's story, and the audience will, I'm not giving anything away, you know, he believes that he might have killed or driven Mozart to death. But we find out at the end that maybe people don't even believe that.
Mm.
And so we're watching it through the lens of a man who is either remembering or misremembering the events
yeah,
of that
yeah.
time.
Did you enjoy Fred, what was his name, the chap who did Salieri?
Oh, F. Murray Abraham.
F. Murray
Abraham. Unbelievable
was,
performance. Yeah, and a man of such great, both as a stage actor, I've seen him play live on Broadway, not in Amadeus, in another production, and of course on cinema, just a master of his craft.
Mm.
And Tom Hulce, of course.
Yes.
Now, here's an interesting thing. A Spring Awakening, I don't know if you saw, was just on.
I missed it.
And is now currently in Joburg. But Tom Hulce is one of the executive producers on the Broadway version of Spring Awakening. Isn't that an interesting little serendipitous link?
Serendipitous, because yeah. I believe he's not doing much acting.
No,
anymore.
No,
it's
and hasn't for
directing.
A long time. Correct, yeah. yeah. Producing and directing now, yeah.
But that was also an odd choice in many ways because of that laugh that
that's
he
right.
develops. And I noticed that Aidan
yes.
has his own little laugh,
yes.
but it's
so
not
that's
quite
in
as
the
manic.
Script. Well, the script is...
Oh, is it in the script?
It is, and it calls for a kind of... You know, he's
a cackle.
A cackle, a wild cackle, and that comes back repeatedly. And this notion that, again, partly based in truth, is that Mozart was famously quite scatological in references in his writing. He had a bit of an obsession with the bottom. and that he was quite vulgar relative to with his language.
Yes.
And I suspect some of that comes from being a child prodigy. You look at any of the young Hollywood film stars that started as a young, they tend to stop maturing or maturation at the age at which they receive maximum attention. And as adults, it becomes a difficult transition for them. So it's an interesting psychological exploration as well, this play, you know, of a man. I mean, I think Mozart, by the end, you sympathize with this poor man who, yes, he was pretty kind of vulgar and a bit obnoxious at times, but by the end was broken and turned away and shunned by so many people in his time.
And chucked into a pauper's grave.
Correct.
That in the film was also very sad and very moving.
100%.
It was pouring with rain. There was all this. It was horrible watching that whole
yeah.
funeral cortege and then just chucking the body in and using the Lacrimosa as the.
So that's my second piece, actually. And it is possibly one of the most beautiful pieces of music, never mind by Mozart of all time. And I remember in the movie, it's so moving.
Mm.
And when I directed the Westford stage play, kind of listening to variations on it and played by various orchestras and artists and choirs. It's just one of my favorite pieces of music.
Do you remember in the film how when they had buried him and thrown whatever they salt or something onto
Correct.
Him, and the camera on the Amen, that grand Amen, pulled away out of the grave and cut to Sir Leary sitting there with a silly look on his face.
Exactly.
It was the most incredible
that
moment.
That juxtaposition. And in fact, you'll see in our play as well the notion of talking about his death. And then Salieri turns to the audience and says, "And I stayed on in the city of musicians, reverenced by all." It's just this terrible juxtaposition. and you know, again, Schaffer's worked with this, whether factually true or not, but it certainly makes for great drama.
It is great drama.
And great play.
And he also was a very respected teacher, Salieri.
Correct.
He taught some of the famous composers.
Absolutely.
I think he might have had a time with Beethoven.
He certainly did.
And with Schubert,
correct.
I think, as well.
He had over, at one point, at his peak, he had over 100 pupils, which is an extraordinary, and all, as you say, turning out to be fairly illustrious musicians in their own right. He was a brilliant man. But what happens if you are a brilliant man, you don't acknowledge it in yourself because you think somebody else is going to live longer.
Exactly.
You know, we've all lived through, on varying scales, with family members or work colleagues or loved ones, where you just feel an insane and sometimes absolutely ridiculous envy or jealousy for someone. And it's the one emotion that can drive you dilly for no known reason.
I.e. Othello.
I.e. Othello.
Absolutely. But now, let's have this Lacrimosa as your next piece, because it is, first of all, the most beautiful piece of music. The theory is that Mozart died halfway through actually writing actually writing that very movement.
Right.
And I remember when I was in a choir once, the conductor showed us in the score Mozart's last actual score.
Oh, wow.
Because, you know, then it was finished
by various
people.
So they can actually determine what that must have been.
Yes, from the original manuscripts, apparently. So here's the Lacrimosa from Mozart's Requiem.
Thank you.
That is a remarkably powerful sequence in the film Amadeus, the Lacrimosa from Mozart's Requiem, more or less where he stopped writing because he died before he could finish the work. And then various people have put it together. But that Lacrimosa also features in the play, fortunately, here in Cape Town. And that's what we're talking about, Amadeus, which has just opened at the Theatre on the Bay. Mm-hmm. And Alan Committee is with me in the studio, and he plays the role of Salieri. And the one thing I was wondering, we were actually chatting during that music, and I don't think either of us knows the answer to this. Did Mozart and Salieri get on? Did Mozart have any respect for Salieri?
From what I've read and understood is that, in fact, they had a pretty civil and convivial relationship. They were both, at certain points in their careers, very well respected by people in the court and, I think, towards each other and of each other. And so, yeah, again, you know, Schaeffer's taken a moment and dramatically enhanced it and made it work for him in terms of the play. But one has to believe that, in fact, they were fine. They were probably pretty pleasant to each other.
Sir Leary is so grand, isn't he, in his court costumes and all that compared. And even when Mozart does wear something smart, he somehow makes it look ridiculous.
Well, now we've got to talk about Ilka Lowe's done a superb job on our costume designs.
I was coming to that. Yeah, you read my mind.
Well, and to Neil Traducer, between the two of them, they were our costume team. And again, the task here is to say, this is the budget we have. We'd love to give you 2 million rand more. We cannot. What can you do? And she's come up with this extraordinary concept of essentially presenting a period silhouette. So if you took the front lights away, it would look period. But of course, when we see the full costumes, we see that it has some punk influence. We've tried to even have some straps. If you see it up close, you'll see there's references to a madhouse and straps and kind of straight jacket detailing to it. She's put some unbelievable writing on some of the costumes. Again, you wouldn't necessarily see it from a distance. But we have this amazing combination of a timeless feel to a period silhouette, if that makes
sense. That's very good. It absolutely makes sense. Yeah. I mean, your costume, that sort of coat that you wear, I remember seeing straps, but stupid me, I didn't think of it possible.
And again, you don't need to. So someone like, this is what her brilliance is, and she'll say this to me and has said that to me and Jeff in our design meetings and go, this is not something that an audience will know what I'm doing, but it will give a feeling and a texture and a nuance. And this is what we do as any, you know, when you work in the brilliant performance area of live theatre, is you collaborate. You want to give an audience, you don't want to spoon feed them. You want to give them something that they can interpret and live with and think about and feel about.
And talk about with people who saw the play as well.
And then have various responses to it. And some people will pick it up and some don't. But what you will know is that there are layers of subtext and or both in the text interpretation, but in the design as well.
Do you mean I have to come and see it again?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
To see all these nuances and subtexts. And then Mozart's costume almost, I thought, had a bit of a clown effect.
100%, yeah. And again, in the kind of hues and the colors that we've chosen as for the court, very much in kind of blacks and grays and whites and subdued, he comes in with a bit of pink.
Yes.
And as you say, some of the outline of the stuff is clownish and certainly a bit more rock and roll in relation to the establishment, which was
steampunk-ish.
Exactly.
And some of the others on stage looked rather grand, some of the ladies and men.
So Jeff Hyland has always said, and I love this, he said, and Jeff's a brilliant designer, both stage and costume in his own right. He's always said, any design of shows of mine, I would like the actors to be able to walk off stage and out into the street. They would get head turns, but no one would say those are stage costumes. They would just think they're outrageously modern and or interesting, high couture. And I think he's achieved that again. So it's an interesting look, and it certainly makes an actor, I've got to tell you now, from having been in a couple of his productions, it makes you feel quite sexy and kind of powerful in the costumes, which is not a bad feeling to have when you're on stage.
Especially if you're Salieri and you're exactly. miserable about everything else, you may as well feel sexy.
Feel good, exactly.
But you also, the role of Salieri has, as I discovered last night, it's a big role. There are lots of almost monologues.
Yes. Well, because it's essentially his story, what it is it's a kind of extended monologue that's been broken up by acting scenes.
Yes. And that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Listen, I've been lucky enough and or, I'm going to say unfortunate enough to have to learn some big parts. Richard III and George,
yes,
and Virginia Woolf and Caveman as a 2.5 hour monologue. So it's not unusual for me to have huge chunks of text. I quite like it. If you've seen my stand-up, you know I love words. I love the power of words and the texture nuances of words. So it's always exciting for me to work with a new author and or playwright. And I got to say that of all the people that I've learnt words, Schaefer writes in a way that's, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's certainly more accessible to learn it. He writes brilliant phrases and beautifully descriptive phrases, but it rolls quite easily off the tongue and therefore can connect to a thought process, which is how we learn words. Mm. You've got to connect it to something, whether it's blocking or intention or subtext. But I have also worked with text. I mean, I found Edward Albee, for example, who's also brilliant, but I found that quite difficult to learn because the poetry is very unusual and the poetic kind of license that he takes with language is very unusual.
As with Shakespeare. Yeah, yeah.
So this I actually found, I loved learning this as well. And to speak it, I don't know if I said this to you last night at the press night, but I said to a couple of people, it's one of the few shows in my life where there have already been a number of occasions where I'm on stage in the moment and Alan, the actor, is going, oh, this is a delight to do. To actually luxuriate in the moment is quite a lovely thing because you don't always get to do it. You know, it might be weeks later that you go, oh, that was a nice play to do. But I'm really enjoying doing it in the moment of doing it because it's such a beautiful
text. How do you learn your lines, Alan? Do you have a secret?
I'll tell you what I don't do, which some actors are able to do, is I can't learn them in a vacuum. So some of them come prepared and words down day one of rehearsal. And I think that's an extraordinary gift and well done to them. But I don't know how to do that. So what I would do is I will read the play 10, 15, 20 times. I'll become very familiar with it.
With the whole play, with all the characters.
Yeah, but certainly with my own part as well. And be able to work for those first week or 10 days on the floor with book in hand. But work so that I can actually engage with fellow actors and not be stuck looking
at
a page. But then the learning comes to linking those words with, as I said earlier, with intention, with blocking in relation to an object or a fellow actor, and then with direction. So if a director said, you know, this is what he's feeling or this is what the scene should be about, then I can relate, that's why he's using those words or that phrase rather than this phrase. And so that specificity around word learning for me comes more naturally when it's linked to the rehearsal period.
It was interesting when the play begins, you sitting with your back to the audience for a while until you swerve around and take over.
It's a beautiful moment. Of course, in the original production, he's sitting in a wheelchair.
That's right.
Because we have to play in a slightly different way, we just found that juxtaposition of his back and this cast of amazing ensemble. And again, I should point out these are eight delightful actors and who were very much younger. Well, Mark Alderkin's in my age group, who's a wonderful emperor, but the rest are fairly young and super enthusiastic and doing a great job of telling a superb story.
Oh, superb story, absolutely. Okay, now, I believe this next piece of music is a great favorite of yours, the Pachelbel Canon.
It is. Now, the way it links to our conversation is that this is Amadeus is a play that I've produced under my production house, Gloucester Productions, which, by the way, comes from the Duke of Gloucester, Richard III. And I've now produced a number of shows over the years, including Virginia Woolf and Richard and Amadeus. But one of my first productions that I ever produced, and it was a number of years ago now, was with Graham Weir, now deceased and sadly missed. Graham Weir and his sister Christine, who had a brilliant a cappella group called Not the Midnight Mass.
Yes,
I'm certain our listeners will remember them fondly. They were quite brilliant. And Graham came to me for the 25th anniversary of Midnight Mass. He wanted to do a show at Theatre on the Bay and at Monte Cassino, and he asked me to direct the show and then produce it. So it's one of the first shows that I produced, and they did the most glorious a cappella version of this canon, which is a superb piece of music in its own right, of course. And in fact, we were talking earlier that there have been so many variations and versions of it, and you can listen to literally one a day for who knows how long and be delighted by the variations. And to listen to these five voices, Graham, his sister, and three others, Jason Ralph, Amanda Tiffin was one of them, and Pierre Malherbe, all superb voices in their own right, coming together in this beautiful, harmonious version of this. It is one of my favorite pieces.
Thank you.
The Canon by Johann Pachelbel. It's pretty well his greatest hit, isn't it, Alan? I mean, if you say the name Pachelbel,
that's what we
immediately think
so
of. So
you know them. Did he write a lot of other music?
He wrote a fair amount. He wrote what sounds like a lot of chamber music.
Right.
He was obviously a Baroque composer.
Yes.
And so things like Concerto Grosso, little concertos for solo instruments. So he was, and I'm trying to think there was a link with Bach, but I can't think what that link was offhand at the moment. But Alan Committee, incidentally, talking about Alan, is my guest on People of Note this week here on Fine Music Radio. And we're discussing Amadeus, an incredibly exciting and, I want to say magisterial, but that's maybe going over the top.
Oh, bless you. I'll take it.
At Theatre on the Bay, which has just opened. And you've been talking about the director, Jeffrey Hyland.
Mm.
But you also sound as though you might have had a hand in helping along. You might not just have been one of the actors coming along to do the thing. It sounds as though you had a finger in the pie of both directing, producing, and all that sort of thing.
Over the years, I've directed a fair amount, and it's something that I love to do. I'm a bit of an alpha type, but an A type. So I do like control, but in the best ways, I think. And it's a tricky one. Having worked with Jeff, I know how he works, and it delights me the way he works. He's an amazingly visual director, but he's also got the knack of really detailing what actors need and want at various points in a process. So I will leave him to that. I cede completely to him. And we have a great relationship in that we do a lot of our discussion and pre-production work in detail, where we can argue and wrestle meaning, interpretation, attitude, and the way into any piece. But then that work, once it's been decided between the two of us, then I step back and I'm an actor in his company. And I think that's important, because we don't want two or three cooks cooking the broth.
Yeah.
So and I cede to him, as I said. But having said that, as a producer, I'm wearing different hats. So putting the team together and getting a great director and a brilliant sound designer, lighting designer, costume designer, casting the play, and then putting all those elements together at the right time in the theater with publicity and marketing. Those all fall under my auspices as well, besides as acting. And
okay.
And I always say to a company where I am both producing and acting that once I'm on the floor with them, I'm their acting colleague. And we don't do, you can't ask me, why wouldn't the S&T for, or who's going to pay for the Uber? Those are for questions for after rehearsal when I'm putting my producer hat on. Mm-hmm. And I'm being very lucky, because I think of that transparency and easy communication lines that actors understand that. All they want is to be communicated with clearly. And so we've been able to kind of traverse that, what can be challenging territory, very easily. And it's been a delight to be able to do both of those. I'm passionate about theatre, both in its kind of generalized form, but specifically in South Africa. And I've learned a lot from my working relationship with Peter Turin, which now extends to close on 30 years.
Wow.
And although a lot of that has been stand-up shows or solo shows, I've been immensely respectful of what he did in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, where he brought out the best of the West End and the best of Broadway.
Marlene Dietrich
and his extraordinary talents. And the truth is, it's harder and harder to do that. With our weakening rand, we cannot, underestimate how difficult it has become to do anything from overseas. And yes, of course, we have superb authors and playwrights in this country, and we need to continue to celebrate new works and original works. And I'd like to think I'd do that as well. But every now and then you want to watch a classic. And by a classic, not necessarily classical music, but classic plays from the 20th century, whether it's Edward Albee or David Hare or Tom Stoppard and the like. And I want to do those. And when I go overseas and I get a chance to watch those shows, I dream big and I kind of go, oh, I'd love to see. Now, sometimes it's because I see a part in there, I go, that's for me. But sometimes it's just about going, I'd love our audience to experience this again. In my years since leaving drama school in the mid-90s, I remember seeing Bill Flynn play Death of a Salesman, Willie Loman, and it was mind-blowing to me, and it made me realize I don't see enough of this on our South African stages.
Mm.
I see some brilliant work, and I'm very grateful for that, but I'd love to see more of that. So part of what this is and what Gloucester Productions tries to do is to bring some of those texts. It might be reframed. It might be done in a slightly different way because of financial constraints, but if we can focus on the story and tell the story as well as we can, wouldn't that be a delight for an audience? I hope so.
One of the things that struck me in the theatre last night was It didn't look as though you'd cut down on expenses. That was the amazing
thing. That's amazing.
Thing.
Well, that's great.
It didn't look, oh, clearly they've not got much money.
Right.
As I said earlier, some of the other actors looked rather grand.
Yes.
And the other thing is that most of the other casts were very young actors.
Correct.
Some of whom I've never heard before.
Correct. Yeah. There's two of them have just graduated, one 2 years out and one is 1 year out of LAMTA, which is the theatre school that sits above Theatre
Yes, and which has just done Spring Awakening.
Correct.
To huge acclaim.
Yeah. So they're lovely. And then the others are, two of them are Joburg based, so that's possibly why you wouldn't know them. But also, as you say, younger cast members are. And again, they don't often get a chance to play in classical text territory, certainly in plays. Musicals, you might. Do a sound, My Fair Lady or a Sound of Music, whatever. So it is nice to work with those younger actors and give them an opportunity. And in a company like this, where they have to do everything, including moving some stuff on stage, it's nice to have that kind of energy around you. And I always call it the spirit of yes, people who approach something with, yes, let's try it until it doesn't work. And that's a beautiful energy to work with.
I'm sure it must be very important for the cast to get on with each other because you're together for a long time.
Absolutely.
Doing the same thing basically every night.
Yeah.
So no one must have strange
moods.
Yeah,
and as
moods.
I've got a little older and it troubles me to say I'm starting to get a little older, but I feel young, is that I've come to realize that you want to work with people, you know, everyone's got, especially in our industry, and by that I mean the theatre industry, whether you're a designer or an actor, director or producer, we've all got an ego, something that creates the work. But the ego needs to be in check and the ego needs to be in relation, as you said, to a whole lot of other egos that are working in collaboration. That collaboration element for me is the most essential part of anything in live theatre. And I now gravitate towards working with people who are good collaborators. If you're a good person and you want to be part of a company, then I'm going to delight in working with you. Because, as you say, we're spending a lot of time together. We become a family
for three or four months. It's fairly intimate, I would
Absolutely.
But now, what about the one-man comedy stuff you
yes.
do? You said you're a bit of a control freak, so there you don't have to worry about other people's egos.
That's right.
And clearly it's something you love.
I do love it. And it's something that came out of drama school. I loved doing comedy. Chris Weir and Jeff, who were my lecturers at that point, didn't actually put me in any stage comedies because they said, well, you can do that. We need to get you better at other things. So by the time they released me out into the industry, I was ready to do whatever I could. And my first ever one-man show was a one-man Richard III because I knew no one would cast me until many, many years later. Yeah. So I played it, playing an actor, playing all 37 parts. And out of that first show back in 1998 at Grahamstown, I realized two things. One is that as much as you can prepare and rehearse a text and people might enjoy it, it was the little improvised asides and comic interludes that I was compelled to make when people, for example, had to enter late into the auditorium and had to cross the stage at Grahamstown to get to the seats. Those interactions, the audience seemed to delight in, and it made clear to them that that particular performance was going to be unique and only for them.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, that is one of the grand elements of stand-up comedy, is to make it look like you're having the thought for the first time, that interesting idea for the first time, sharing it with an audience, and then improvising or riffing off their energy and their participation. So the stand-up came quite early to me, and it became one of the things that I'm really very blessed and happy to be able to have a career as a stand-up. Also because it pays fairly well or relatively well in the kind of stuff we do in live theatre, and by that I can go and do corporate entertainment or MC and facilitation. Those skill sets have brought me the finances that I can then channel back into doing the pieces that I want to do as well, which includes things like Amadeus.
Just a last question that's actually fascinated me ever since I've read your biographies and known you is, what made you leave teaching?
The teaching for me was always a means to an end. And let me not, I should say immediately, let me not disparage and make that sound like,
no.
I am hugely in love with education and educators. And my sister was one of a superb primary school teacher for many years. She now teaches primary school teachers to teach. And I think she does amazing work. But for me, I remember right back in when I was in Standard 5 telling my folks that I wanted to become an actor. I loved live theatre. And I could see my dad doing some brilliant acting as his face dropped. And then he lifted up and said, of course, we'll support you. And he said, perhaps you should have something to back you up. And teaching was the first thing that came out of my mind because I was lucky enough to have good teachers. And so I was always going to do those two things. and use them to kind of influence each other. And it did. By being a teacher, I learned crowd control and keeping the attention of everybody, reading a room, working with specificity, voice control, modulation, phrasing, all of that stuff. Not consciously at the time, but when I look back, I go, wow, what a wonderful classroom the classroom was for me.
For you too, as ahead of your career.
Yeah, and so I love it. But it was always going to be a shift from teaching initially in back into theater and doing it full time.
And that's where we are now. And you're playing a bucket list role.
I am, sir. What and delighting in it.
And it's been great to talk to you. And best of luck. Does this end now in Cape Town?
Yes. We had a lovely run in Joburg. Yes. We don't normally start in Joburg, but we did this time. So we're here until the 18th of May. It's a fairly long season. And, you know, I'm encouraging people, maybe for this reason alone, it's not often we get to see these great texts. So just for that reason, if you can, come down to one of our most, I think, most beautiful theatres, not only in yes. Western Cape, but in the country, yes. to Theatre on the Bay, and enjoy, I think, a delightful evening of great text and interesting characters.
Here is what I'd like to say. Alan Committee, thank you so much. What's your last piece? The Planets.
The Planets. Beautiful piece of music. I used it in one of my stand-up shows. And Jupiter is the piece we're listening to, The Bringer of Jollity, which is the other side of me, a little bit of stand-up comedy. You won't get quite as many laughs in Amadeus from me, but you will from the Emperor, and I will bring you laughs again soon.
Alan Committee, thank you very much. People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
FMR 101.3 FM.